This is GamesAtWork.biz with Phaedra Boinodiris, Michael Martin, and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone, and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with. This is episode 104, CES, Sales, and Sentient. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Michael Rowe here on a beautiful... No, I lied. It's a gloomy day. There's clouds in the sky. There's water falling from the sky, and it's cold. It's cold out there, but it's a great day because I'm here with my wonderful co-host, Michael Martin.
Hooray! I'm here too, but I have an empty coffee cup, so my day is now gloomy as well.
Yes, yes, gloomy is good.
But we have exciting things to talk about, which will ungloomify our day tremendously.
Absolutely, absolutely. And one of the exciting things that I've been up to lately is I was at CES this year.
As you are most years recently. So you had a grand time. I got to see your picture taken as it was going on. It was really cool.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff going on. It's interesting. The Internet of Things, which was a part of the show in 2014, was now pretty much the entire show. It was the show. It was the show. And what was good was there were a heck of a lot less connected toothbrushes and silly things. And the maturity that many of the businesses who showed off connected things last year has dramatically improved. So I'll give a couple of insights or comments, and then maybe we can just kind of riff for a while. There were really three areas that I was looking at. They were connected vehicle, which was part of my day job, right?
Sure.
Connected home.
Home.
And connected health. And connected health includes all the wearables. And so, you know, last year, 2014 again, we saw kind of a coming out, or a, not even a coming out, but a very strong presence from a couple of key players around wearables. You know, you had the Fitbits, you had Y-Things, you had Garmin, you had Jawbone, right?
Right.
So those were the big ones. This year, I swear, it was 5 to 10x the number of additional players all kind of replicating what everybody did last year. So the good news there is, as a consumer, it's probably going to drive down the price in the market for a lot of these wearable technologies under the guise of connected health. And I don't mean medical devices. I mean connected health, right?
Sure.
But what it also allowed is for companies like Garmin and Y-Things and others to kind of show the next generation of much more exciting, differentiating products. So, for example, you know, I use the Y-Things Pulse. Mm-hmm. And I think you use a Fitbit. Is that right?
Nope. I'm on the Team Jawbone.
You're on Team Jawbone. Okay. I did not see Jawbone there this year.
Maybe they were hidden. They actually introduced several new products too.
Yeah, and I didn't see them. That doesn't mean they weren't there, right? But it was just it was huge again this year. It was even more huger, to use good grammar there, than last year. So what Y-Things did, which was kind of a left turn compared to everyone else. Y-Things introduced their Activa line, or Active line, which...
Activa is the yogurt, isn't it?
Yes, it keeps you regular. but what was really cool about it was a watch. And what I mean by a watch was, it was a watch. It was a...
Right, it was a watch face.
Traditional analog watch face. And it wasn't, you know, a watch face on a computer screen. It was a watch. And what they had with it is then just another mechanical odometer-like thing that would count up until you got to your 10,000 steps. Well, you say, well, yeah, everybody's got a step counter today. Heck, most phones have them too, right?
Sure.
What was interesting was that simple watch also did step, run, bike, swim, sleep, you know, all those other metrics and measures.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty neat too, you know, and the interface of it was really good, but the challenge is now you're wearing a watch.
Yeah. Well, which, those were everywhere too, let me tell you. Watches were everywhere. Android Wear, Samsung, you name it, everybody had their, we've got to get our watch out into the market before Apple releases their watch this quarter.
Well, I really like the Motorola one. I think that one is pretty slick.
No, I'm waiting for the Apple one. I'm gonna get it sight unseen when it releases, just because I want to play with it. And as you and I've talked about, I have my own little wasted time app that I want to extend to the watch face and kind of do some interesting things with. But watches were everywhere.
I can only imagine, and I did see that level of reporting too. So the one thing I wanted to ask you from your firsthand experience is whether you're seeing that wearables are being considered more disposable electronics, because with the competition, obviously the price point will be driven down. But I'm wondering if that's something that people and companies that are there are now starting to consider the wearable device as being something you might have for a time, and then you replace it quickly again with another one, and you can do that because the price point is so low, or if the value proposition that the various companies and people that are there are, no, you're in our ecosystem, it's a high quality device, it will last a long time, and yeah, okay, it's going to get cheaper, but it's still a last a long time kind of thing.
Can I give you a third option?
Yeah.
The third option, Swarovski released a wearable. So the jewelry high-end model is coming into play. The differentiation by segmenting the market so that I've got, you know, Wyfing's watch, which looks like a watch. It's much more of a jewelry look than just a consumable that you can throw away with next year's model, right? Swarovski's wearable, definitely much more in the jewelry classification. The differentiation is style and not necessarily capabilities, because the basic tech and the basic ability to track, you know, based off of algorithms, steps, running, etc., is there. The only one that I would say is a little bit different, and I actually saw one of these in person on a human being this week, was Garmin's, I can't remember the exact number, I want to say it was like a 950 or 970 or 930 watch, which could differentiate between, you know, biking outdoors or riding on an exercise bike, running outdoors, running on an indoor track, running on a treadmill, right? And actually, you know, differentiate between stationary movement versus directional movement, which is, that's awesome, right? That kind of, again, raises the bar on the algorithms that are going on with wearables versus just, you know, I can do some level of accelerometer detection, and therefore I know you took a step.
You know, there to me, there's an opportunity to provide that level of algorithm and chip, the embedded capability to watchmakers. You know, that you could imagine a situation where, for example, an Apple Watch set of capabilities might be embedded directly within another company's watch themselves, or a limited set of function like from Fitbit or whatever could be embedded within an existing watch too. And you're starting now to get the benefits of both worlds with upgradable functionality and memory that can be enhanced over time. So if you have a Swarovski or Tag Heuer, I think is now starting to move in this direction too, kind of a timepiece, you can have some of those other capabilities directly brought into it.
I've seen multiple stories. I didn't get to see any of these at CES, but of the companies that are extending the traditional watches by adding in a sensor in the watch band. Right.
Oh, so, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And actually, it's not the Garmin 950, which is a panel for airplanes, like an instrument panel in an airplane. It's the Garmin Forerunner 920 XT and 910 XT, which are these multi-function watches that really kind of give you multi-sport capabilities between running and swimming and walking and treadmills, etc. So, don't want to confuse people with the wrong version of the watch.
No, you don't want to do that. I'm just pulling up the other thing too. Mont Blanc had something called an E-strap.
That's it.
So is that what you're thinking of?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, so I saw the pictures of that too. We'll drop a link in the show notes. And to me, it did look pretty uncomfortable. You know, that A, you have to kind of turn your wrist over to look at it, and then B, just the width of that thing that's now sitting on top of your strap on the underside of your wrist. You know, if you're going to shoot a web out of it, maybe okay. But, you know, if it's telling you you got 3 Facebook alerts, maybe not so much.
Right. but so in wearables, I think you're seeing that differentiation of the market where it's going both upscale and downscale. Because, you know, I was seeing devices that looked like the design of the Apple Watch, maybe not the level of metal or gold on it, but that were, $25, $30 devices designed to give to your kids or tracking your kids.
Well, that's why I was asking on the disposable nature of this, because some of these devices are, to borrow a phrase from Alton Brown, a unitasker kind of thing, right? And yep. You don't want to have like a wrist full of straps and bands and all that are doing lots of, you know, each one doing one thing. But there may be certain circumstances where something like that is about right. I mean, you might have one that you're going to use for swimming because it is a specific, you know, wearable that's going to measure respiratory rate of, you know, how long are you, your strokes, a bunch of other dynamics that could be very, very interesting to you if you're like a major swimmer guy, but it doesn't help you that much on the biking side.
Right. You know? Right. And that's it, right? Because I, exactly the point, I've got the Garmin Swim, but it's only good for when I'm swimming.
Yeah.
And so these multifunction devices, really, really good idea, but at some point they become, you know, let's take it the ludicrous speed, right? So that was connected health or wearables. Connected home, lots of stuff there, but nothing really earth-shattering. The only one that I thought that was kind of interesting was a small kind of startup company based out of university in Tennessee that was doing a very, very simple model for elder care in the connected home space. And what they did is they had these plugs that would monitor. You could get in a 1, 2, or 3 pack, and you would plug them into your elderly parent or grandparent's house for certain appliances, and it would use analytics to
figure out if they're still alive,
patterns, and alert you if things did not happen in the appropriate pattern. Like, you know, if every morning your mom or your grandma gets up at you know,
switches on the coffee machine,
switches on the coffee machine, and then goes to turn on Good Morning America, right? There's certain power utilizations that are going to occur that will trigger that event and let you know. And so since they didn't want to, you know, require that you then go into the house and set up an entire Wi-Fi router and, you know, blah, 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 they actually built the communication mechanism in the power plug.
The wall port does that.
Yeah, the wall plug basically has a 3G modem into it. And provides a service that will track the pattern and give you alerts and keep you comfortable or make you feel comfortable that things are happening that should happen. And over time, build up that analytical model to then only give you alerts when things fall out of the norm.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's really clever.
Yeah. Yeah. It was extremely clever. And like I said, most of the rest of Connected Home was kind of just the next iteration from last year, which is, you know, every major vendor, including, I think it was either Home Depot or Lowe's. I think it was Lowe's, is providing their full stack router, right, hub to manage the Connected Home, and then their proprietary one-off standard-based devices and sensors for the rest of things in the house, whether that's cameras or door locks or you know, whatever, which I feel from a market perspective is really going to cause problems longer term. Because it's not creating that open ecosystem where anyone can build a system in their house, but it's, you know, right back to where we were, you know, when I first moved up into the North Carolina area and saw the house of the future, and it was, you know, 15 plus years ago, and everything was a connected
X12
home.
X12 or something.
X10, but it was all kind of closed proprietary system built by one manufacturer and one piece of software, et cetera. And, you know, I was really looking forward to see somebody like the Linux Foundation's Allscene Alliance and the adoption of their set of standards that they're promoting to make easy discoverability and connectivity and communication between different vendor devices. And, again, I didn't see every single booth across the entire show and analyze them in graphic detail, but I only saw two places where I saw the Allscene Alliance listed.
Yeah, so now that comment on your photo stream makes more sense. I see this, and I think that's the place where I'm struggling is that if you're a company that is trying to deploy, you know, smart plugs and sensors for light or heat or whatever else, the objective probably is to try to do a vendor lock-in, right? You know, I want to lock you into my home. So,
look at the appliances in your house, right? And they're fairly new for many of them, and they're not all one vendor.
Sure, sure.
And each vendor doesn't necessarily provide all the appliances you need.
Well, and the trick to me then is that your hub, your home hub, is going to be what's going to do the translation layer between proprietary network for appliances and proprietary network for lighting and proprietary network for toothbrushes or whatever, right? You could have the hub do the translation layer of all that and then provide the dashboarding and the reporting and the scripting to say, hey, when I start brushing my teeth in the morning, you know, wait 5 minutes, then turn on the coffee maker because I'll be ready for my coffee about then.
Yes, but that requires, again, an open set of standards, and even the hub providers right now are building closed ecosystems.
Well, it does, but that's an opportunity for the something to sit on the hub that can do the standards translation, you know, some sort of message bus, you know, home service bus kind of thing, right?
A home service bus. Oh, excellent. Yep. And then finally, the most mature area, and I thought the most
cars.
Exciting, was cars. And if you saw my stream, and I'll put links to my blog where I was tracking a lot of this, there's a lot of cars in there. And across the board, every car company had a consistent story around connected vehicle, and they all focused on connected vehicle except for one. And the one that didn't was Toyota, which was showing off their fuel cell technology and the fact that they were opening up their patent portfolio in order to compete with the electrical car patent portfolio that Tesla just opened up on batteries. But everybody else, it was consistent. And the most exciting part was we are 1 year later since Google announced their Open Auto Alliance and since Apple announced their CarPlay capability, and almost every OEM supported one or both of those standards in a year, as well as potentially their own proprietary standard, making the choice to the driver on which platform that they want to engage in and make it in such a way that the capabilities across the vehicle enable your mobile platform to drive that connected vehicle environment. And like I said, the exciting part was in 1 year since these standards were announced, they're now in the cars. The car industry does not move that fast.
So was there any consistency, for example, in the gestures that people were using? You know, in the various cars, is there any standards around that if you wave your hand a certain way, that was going to change the environmental controls or something?
I saw two car companies with gestures, and I didn't see enough to say they were standard. But I'm sorry, I really don't get gestures in the car.
Oh, I don't either. I mean, when I think about it, the tactile response, you know, that's what I look for, right? You know, I know exactly if I'm going to click up a temperature or the radio volume three notches, I could feel that.
Yeah. But gestures, I mean, that's just I'm not disparaging anybody's desire to innovate, but that's just crazy. You're supposed to be paying attention to the drive and the safety environment, and you're wildly gesticulating while driving down the road. There's only one gesture that I think should be legally allowed to be used, and I think it varies by country.
Oh, yeah. It's a waving of hi when you see someone who's driving.
I think it's called
like
a Brooklyn salute. But CES was fantastic.
Of all the cars that were there, what was your favorite one and why?
You know the manufacturer I'm going to say.
I kind of do, but I thought I would ask anyway.
And they actually had two cars. One was a concept car that they drove out on stage during a keynote on Monday night. I was not able to be at the keynote, but one of my colleagues who was out there with me did go to the keynote. And this was the Mercedes car of the future, which was the exact same concept designs that they showed in 1950. I mean, this thing was awesome looking. I mean, crazy things like when a person walks behind the car, the lights on the front of the car would actually show you through a ripple effect in the lighting across the entire grille that somebody's crossing behind that car. So you as an oncoming driver would know that there's someone about to pop out on the other side of the car and not run them over.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Sweet.
I mean, that, and it was fully self-driving, and the driver and the passenger seat swiveled backwards so you could have like four adults facing each other while the car's driving down the road for you. And you know, play a game of Pinochle. But and the windows, there were actual windows, even though when you look at the car, you don't see any. The car was this sleek silver brushed metal look, and the windows had the same coloring on it. You could look out, but you couldn't look in. So it just looks like this steel tube driving down the road. Pretty freaking awesome.
Well, we know that a number of law enforcement agencies would not be very pleased about that. You know,
well,
I know
you saw the story in the news.
Example.
You saw the story in the news this week about the last couple of years, some of the U.S. law enforcement are using devices that basically can see through the house.
Ooh, no, I hadn't.
Oh, I will put a link in the show notes to that story. It was actually in USA Today about some legal challenges because, you know, if you're in your house, and basically it's kind of like a stud finder, but it can sense like 30 to 40 yards beyond the wall it's pressed against. And it will sense motion as little as somebody breathing.
Wow.
So you could be standing still and hiding behind a wall, but you better not breathe.
Okay, well, I will not
stuff.
Go anywhere closer to that. So let me turn maybe to the Audi car company because there
was
a
cool
number
too.
Of pictures that you shared about that. What was the key cool feature about Audi?
That was another self-driving car,
mm-hmm.
and they drove that one too, it was much more a self-driving production car compared to the Mercedes self-driving concept car. Mm-hmm. Pretty amazing there too. I mean, the self-driving car has been predicted to be available in high-end cars by 2025, etc. but we are so close to that. I mean, earlier last year at one of the auto shows, GM said, you know, I think it was 2015 or 2016 models of their high-end Cadillacs would be self-driving on the interstate. And so these are production level cars that have enough sensors and enough capabilities to do self-driving in pretty demanding environments. And when you think about LiDAR and radar that's built into many of the cars and the algorithms and sensors for lane assist, et cetera, you start adding all these things together and you can easily see, you know, hands-free cruise control, which is the first major step to truly self-driving cars.
I know that's going to happen pretty soon for all of us. I can't say that I'm really looking forward to that day, to be honest. I'd much rather still have the ability to hit the clutch, put it into first, and move on out. But there are a ton of advantages to self-driving cars for sure. So we're going that direction. And as much as we want to say, get off of my lawn, you kids, they're coming.
Well, so that's a quick crazy thing about CES. I will add one more thing on there. It was great to catch up with our friends over at Emotive do the race car game with the new headset that they have that should be coming to those of us who back their Kickstarter. And I was able, I think it was 4.21 seconds, do the drag race in 4.21 seconds using only my mind.
Well, that'll be great. I'm looking forward for mine to arrive as well. And I know they've had their production challenges, and it's going to be super cool to give it a real exercise and see how this goes. So, yay, Emotive.
Yes. So our co-host Phaedra sent a link on a fantasy sales team game. And Michael, you had some thoughts on this one.
Oh, absolutely. So the link in the show notes will take you to fantasysalesteam.com. And this is a small business that is based in Texas, I believe, in Austin, I think, if I remember right. Yeah,
yes.
Bee Cave Road. How's that for a neat name? So these guys have found a way to gamify sales contests by hooking into whatever CRM solution you might have deployed at your company, and to not just have it be so that the person who sells the most widgets is going to get a new large screen TV, but to use the analytics and the data that's flowing out of the customer relationship management software and kick it into a visualization that looks like a game where the players in this game, whether it might be baseball is the featured one on the site, but they do basketball, they do American football, they do football for the rest of the world, of course, too, that you can draft a fantasy team, much like you do in fantasy sports. And in doing so, you know, you pick the salespeople from your team that you would like to have on your fantasy team. You put them in the appropriate positions. And in doing so, you can actually win as a team and win with your fantasy team as much as you could by winning as an individual contributor. And I thought that is just amazingly clever. And the points that they bring up in their sales pitch about why they're different and new and so on is such that you don't want to consistently reward the top 1-2% that are always in the top 1-2%. You want to motivate and encourage and drag your entire team to higher and higher reaches of sales attainment. And people drop out of sales contests when they see that they have no chance of winning. So
yeah,
it's cool.
I thought that was the interesting part because, you know, my first read when I looked at this, I was like, aren't sales contests a game anyway?
No, they sure are.
So what's new here? Come on, guys. Yawn. Then, you know, look through some of the videos and the white papers that they have on there. And it does seem like an interesting way of really changing the mix and the dynamics of gamifying sales contests. And like you said, I think the most interesting aspect is the team encouragement aspect and the ability to dynamically, you know, just like you would in, say, fantasy football, trade players, you know, change your team to keep everybody engaged up until the end which, you know, it's one of those the rising tide floats all boats type games, so that everybody continues to strive instead of, as you say, drop out at the, you know, let's say I'm a bad seller. Well, I'm not a seller at all, thank God. but let's say I'm a bad seller and I'm doing poorly in a traditional contest. I'm just going to throw my hands up and give up. And this one, it's much more likely that I'll say, hey, you know, I can provide these types of skills into the mix on a fantasy team to where we all move forward. Maybe I'm really good at getting the customer started down the path. I just don't close very well. And maybe you're really good at being a closer, but your ability to kind of mine the data and find the right customers is not very good. So together, you and I could be a much more effective sales team, exactly, than somebody who's just, you know, the constant one performer of sales because they're just a overall really good, but not really powerful in any one area.
Well, and this encourages that level of teamwork too, so that if you are the number one performer, you are having reasons to help your teammates succeed too.
Yep.
So I think this is extraordinarily clever, and it really falls into some of the things I've been thinking about quite a lot here as well, of API exposure of certain key systems of records to allow for other services to live on top of them and do something different.
Yep. Really, you know, creating those application program interfaces so that others can take advantage of data in a unique way, which kind of gets us back to that Internet of Things idea too, right? Of tying people, sensors, metrics, and performance all together through strong analytics to drive behavior change and capabilities.
Right, exactly. Wow. Exactly. So Phaedra, thank you for that, because this was a fantastic link, I think, for us to be able to talk about today. And Michael, you had one other thing that you saw that is dealing with one of our good old friend kind of games, Mr. Mario.
Yeah, this is actually really interesting. So it's got a pretty long video, so you know, we're not going to do a detailed analysis of the video on the podcast, but I highly recommend our listeners to go look at this. And basically, it's a team out of
the University of Tübingen.
Yes, I can say that too.
Oh, you can?
Yes, the University of Tübingen in Germany, that was changing the dynamics of the Mario game for an AI contest, and actually having it so that Mario in the game learns behaviors and can use that to basically play through the entire game. So when he has certain moods, right? If he's hungry, he goes chasing after coins. If he's not hungry, he becomes more inquisitive and does exploration of the game. When he sees a certain creature and he does not know anything about it, you can, you know, make him jump on top of it, and he realizes when he jumps on top of it, it kills it. And so you can then say, hey, go kill the bad guys, and it'll learn that anything, you know, certain things, how to kill them. And so they actually used a programming technique in order to play through the whole game based off of a learning algorithm. And that learning then changes mood, changes behavior, changes technique in the game for Mario. And it was pretty interesting to see the types of insight you can create a game to learn about itself.
Well, I think it's really clever in a lot of ways, in that the interaction that a player can have with the AI and in the game, I think is rather interesting. And I almost wonder, you know, what are the responses that might happen if you tried to trick Mario? If you try to say, you know, go hug a turtle.
Well, he would learn when he hits the turtle that he dies. That was the cool thing, right? I mean, it was... It's really interesting, and again, it's the idea of a learning algorithm, right? And that allows you to then improve or gain insight about an environment. It was really cool. I highly recommend it. I'd love to get people's thoughts and insights on how you know, games can be used as a method for increasing insights in the AI world. And I think, you know, this game, our good old buddy Mario, was a cool way of doing it.
I agree. So it'll be interesting to see and learn a little bit more about it. And I was so happy to see it from the University of Tübingen. This is where my family's from in Germany. So that's so cool.
I think that's what we have for our show this week. We'd like to say thank you to our former co-host, Sandy Kearney, who has had to bow out of the show due to basically real life overload. We will miss you on the show and always welcome back as a special guest.
Absolutely, Sandy. Hope to see you soon. And as we close, there's one thing I would like to end on, just because, you know, this is me and you know me. I learned yesterday evening that there is a new game that just was announced and made available. Oh, yeah.
Is it 8-bit?
No. But I will.
Is it a freemium game?
I will be playing it soon. And no, it's a $5 game. But unfortunately, there are in-app purchases, so I'm not happy about that. But it is a $5 game, and it is the Lego Movie iOS app. So that
everything is going to be awesome about that game.
Everything is awesome. So I'm looking forward to kicking back, get a glass of wine, and playing me some Lego later tonight.
Excellent. I think the glass of wine sounds great. Well, everybody, we appreciate all your feedback and your insights, and hope you enjoyed this week's show, and we'll see you later.
Bye.
See ya. You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.